go ahead and call the subcommittee meeting for Senate File 193 to order. This is a bill that addresses mandating vaccinations across quite a few issues. I'm going to reserve comment at this time. Senator Costello, do you have anything to say at this point?
I think it's a pretty comp. There's quite a bit to this bill. It's not just one thing. And I think there's some conflicting principles that we have to consider here and try to figure out what we best do to protect people's freedoms. So that's all I want to say right now.
Okay. Senator Yoakum?
Sure. Just briefly, I have some real concerns with the bill, but I know there's a lot of people who want to speak today, so let's get at it. Let's let the public speak. Thank you, Senator.
You bet. So if we have anybody from the lobby who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay.
Well, we got 83 people on, so...
Somebody's going to want to speak.
We've got a couple with their hands up now.
Yep. J.D. Davis.
Good afternoon, Senators. I'm J.D. Davis, and I represent the Iowa Association of Business and Industry. And today I'd like to confine my remarks to just Division 1 of the bill, which goes to the employee-employer relationship as it goes to vaccinations. I want to say that at ABI, we recognize the free will right of any individual in Iowa to determine on their own whether or not they wish to be vaccinated for any disease, respect that. We also respect the free will right of employers to, arrange their business place in any way they see fit for the conduct of business. And we don't think that the choice that's been made in the bill to have the rights of the employee or prospective employee trump those of an employer respects that free will decision of both parties. I think decisions have consequences, and if someone decides that they wish not to have vaccination, there are some consequences they're going to have to weigh when they make that decision. So those would be our remarks on Division 1 of the bill.
Okay. Thank you. Dennis Tibben?
Good afternoon, Senators. Dennis Tibben with the Iowa Medical Society and the American Academy of Pediatrics Iowa chapter. Both have concerns with the legislation. I want to speak specifically to Division 2 of the bill, that section speaking to the inability of healthcare providers to restrict their employees and also to restrict patients that have chosen to not get vaccinated. Wanting to recognize, as Mr. Davis certainly pointed out there, the decision of the individual employer, but we also need to recognize that in the healthcare setting, it is a different set of circumstances. And putting in place that division, we believe, would unnecessarily restrict the ability for a healthcare setting to set up protocols to keep their patients safe. So we really think that if this legislation is to move forward, that division should be struck. Thank you very much.
Rachel Goss.
Hi, Rachel Goss, Executive Director for the Family Planning Council of Iowa, and we are registered against this bill. So I'll just keep it really quick. As an executive director of a nonprofit healthcare organization, I can tell you that as leaders, we understand the risk management and liability headache of mandating a vaccination potentially at our work site. So if we do so, it is simply because we feel it's in the best interest of our staff and the patients that we serve. Thank you.
Thank you. David Edelman.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to speak. Actually, everyone that's already spoken we're in full agreement on behalf of our clients, Unity Point, Iowa Biotech Association, Family Physicians, Iowa Osteopathic Medical Association. We feel that government intervention of telling a business what to do or how to do it, or who to hire, how to hire them, is counterintuitive or counterproductive to the efficiencies of the work that we are doing. So both Division One as well as Division Two, we have some concerns with, but understand Senator Costello's concerns about private individual rights as well. So there is a balance, I think, that needs to be struck, but right now we just can't get on board with the language that exists in the legislation. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Nicole Prosh.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. I appreciate it. And Senator Yoakum, we appreciate your time today. I represent the Iowa Hospital Association. We're currently registered against the bill for the very reasons that you've heard from some of our counterparts. We just have some concerns for our hospitals not being able to make decisions that relate to their employees and to their facilities. And we do think we understand the individual rights, but also understand that there needs to strike a balance depending on the type of facility that you may be working in. So those are our thoughts. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Dawn Richardson.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We got you.
Okay, great. My name is Dawn Richardson. I'm the Director of Advocacy for the National Vaccine Information Center, a 501c3 nonprofit charity founded in 1982, and we support SF-193. Thank you for this opportunity. SF-193 enacts reasonable, equal protections so people are not segregated and discriminated against over vaccination or immunity status. Because of COVID-19, we have seen travel restrictions, employment discrimination, and right of access to public venues over masking and testing, and now it has started over vaccination. Nobody is saying reasonable precautions shouldn't be taken, but it crosses the line when healthy, law-abiding citizens are excluded from day-to-day life. Vaccine mandates deny healthy, law-abiding citizens access to a free marketplace. New vaccine mandates could have devastating impacts on the Iowa economy as critical employees and customers who don't want to take a vaccine are turned away from tourism, travel, healthcare, and long-term care, emergency services, sports events, insurance, childcare, and education. Recent surveys of hospital staff, frontline workers, nursing home staff, and firefighters in ranges from 20 to 60% said they would not take a COVID-19 vaccine. Critical public safety and care infrastructures will be severely compromised as those who don't want a vaccine will leave these areas of the workforce. Many healthcare workers have already been fired for refusing flu vaccines and pertussis vaccines. Patients have been denied care and thrown out of practices for not taking certain vaccines. COVID-19 vaccine mandates have already started. The Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission updated guidelines on December 16th, delineating how employers can legally require COVID-19 vaccines in the absence of state laws like this one prohibiting it. There are 29 states now considering bills similar to this one to protect informed consent to vaccination without discrimination or penalty. Iowa can take the lead in this important movement by passing SF-193. Thank you.
Thank you. Lena Tucker-Reinders.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Lena Tucker-Reinders, and I'm the Executive Director of Iowa Public Health Association. We are registered against Senate File 193 because we know that vaccines are safe, effective, and one of the most powerful tools that we have to keep Iowans healthy. We agree that people need to make informed choices about their health care, and we believe that the laws in place in Iowa already allow that. We do have medical exemption, which is important for people who do have who have allergies and reasons that not to be vaccinated medically. We already have the religious exemption in Iowa. We know from other states that have passed philosophical exemptions that vaccine declinations increase, vaccine hesitancy increases, and overall vaccination rates increase once those laws are passed. I also like to point out that among the people that are not here today, even though we have 84 on the call, are the countless public health and medical professionals on the front line of COVID response and prevention efforts. Please don't be led to believe that only those present are passionate about this issue. Again, among the reasons that we are against this bill is because vaccines are safe, tested, and reviewed post-market. From the initial human subjects approval to the multiple rounds of testing, the vaccines are required to pass before FDA approval. And even once they are approved for use, we still have multiple systems like VAERS and now VSAFE that are in place to monitor unanticipated reactions. Vaccines are tested for efficacy, safety, and efficiency, and are shown time and time again to be safe individually and in the recommended childhood series, which was designed, by the way, to counterbalance the waning immunity that's first given from a mother to child during pregnancy and following in breastfeeding. Finally, we know that vaccine hesitancy is a real concern here in Iowa. Iowa's vaccination rates are in decline at the same time that anti-vaccine advocacy in Iowa is increasing. By our counting, in the past 10 years, there was an average of about 2 vaccine-related bills introduced in the Iowa legislature per year. That number jumped to 21 last year. Vaccine hesitancy spreads via social media influencers and passionate advocates who I, of course, believe generally care about the well-being of their children. And I do believe that they are doing what they have been told is right to protect them. The problem is that misinformation and false data can be shared to thousands with only a click. That information doesn't have to be accurate. So social media isn't held to the same standards as peer review as scientific studies is. It only has to plant a seed of doubt, regardless of how unfounded, and hesitancy begins to take root. Iowa's public health and medical professionals and scientific community are experts dedicated to the protection, care, and safety of our children and all Iowans. We are concerned that bills like SF-193 will increase vaccine hesitancy in our state and endanger public health in Iowa.
Thank you. Shonda Burke.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. So I am a lobbyist for Informed Choice Iowa. We are in support of this bill. Also individually, I am a certified medical assistant. So I'm going to address Division 2 specifically because I have seen this one in action. I have watched patients when I was working in the clinic be dismissed because they were not following the CDC guidelines for vaccines. Even if that was just skipping one, delaying one, I've seen patients dismissed for that. We think it's really important that all Iowans have access to the same healthcare. All children should have access to healthcare regardless of their vaccination status. They should not be dismissed from clinics because of their vaccination status. I've also experienced, like I said, as a medical assistant, I've experienced it as an employee. Huge segregation and definitely was treated differently because I would not get the flu vaccine. So I was threatened if I didn't get it, I would lose my job. So eventually I did end up quitting because of that, because I'm not going to be threatened with my personal health decisions being put, you know, in the line of you do this or you don't work. No other health decisions are like that, you know, blood pressure medication, anything like that. It's completely up to you between you and your doctor, not between you and your employer. And I believe that's definitely something that should be protected because I've seen it not be protected. And I know, like myself and others that are leaving the healthcare industry because of that lack of protection.
Okay. Just when you say lack of protection, can you give me some idea? So really what we're looking at here is a balance of interests, the interests in businesses and healthcare facilities to have people vaccinated versus a person's legitimate interest in having autonomy over their own body and being concerned about the risks, the attendant risks, which are real with vaccinations. Could you talk about some of the risks that we're really talking about here for people that are concerned about vaccinations for their children or themselves? You know, children when I was young probably had 3 or 4 vaccinations. I don't know where it is now, but I believe it's north of 60. And just briefly address that for me, if you would.
Yeah, the current number is 72. That would be the number that a child gets by the time they're 18. And that doesn't count the COVID vaccine. So add to that. So yeah, the risks, I mean, you read a package insert, which is the little itty bitty piece of paper that comes in the box with the vaccines, not the VIS sheet that you're giving out that patients don't read. So you read that and the risks are very real. Like for the flu shot, for instance, the one that I was going to be required to have to continue my job, Guillain-Barré syndrome, seizures, death, those are all listed potential side effects. And as far as I know, someone had mentioned the safety testing that vaccines go through. It's called a gold standard placebo test, and all prescription medications go through that. Vaccines do not go through that. So they are not tested the same way that like a prescription medication is. Not even close.
I appreciate you saying that, but what authority do you have to make that statement? What's the authoritative literature you're relying on to make that statement?
That would be the vaccine insert, as well as the laws that are currently in place federally for vaccine manufacturers. They are not required, nor do they do gold standard placebo testing. But yeah, that's all on the vaccine insert. The actual little piece of paper that's in the box with the vaccine, that's all there. And that's, again, something that we don't go over with patients before we give them a vaccine. We hand them a little sheet of paper. It's called a VIS statement, a vaccine information sheet. It covers maybe about 2% of what the vaccine information sheet covers. The vaccine information sheet will go over clinical studies, what they were, how long they took, what they used for a placebo, if they used a placebo, that kind of thing.
Do you have any insight you could share with us on why the bar is set lower for vaccinations than prescription drugs in terms of testing for possible complications, contraindications that you'd see in a physician's desk reference?
The biggest one
if I take a certain prescription, I can go to my PDR and see what the contraindications are. So with vaccinations, is there a reference out there that can show you the potential contraindications for mixing of vaccinations?
No, that would have to be studied, and it's not studied. Like, for instance, the CDC current childhood immunization schedule, the way that it is given, it has never been tested for synergistic effects, which is how they interact with each other when they're given together as they're recommended. That's never been tested for safety. We just assume that as long as you give it in a different limb, then it's fine, no big deal.
So, for instance, we're now talking about COVID vaccination. What are the known attendant risks associated with the COVID vaccination that you know of?
Well, we're seeing a lot of people like pass out after getting it. And, you know, I mean, why are they passing out? I want to know why I'm going to get this and potentially pass out. That's a big concern. Why all of a sudden healthy people are passing out. We've seen there was a stadium out in California that was giving them out, and they had 6 people have an anaphylactic reaction and need epinephrine. An anaphylactic reaction is not a little deal. It's a big deal. Like, even though you can give epinephrine and that person can start breathing again, that person still needs to go to the emergency room and be treated thoroughly because of the side effects of epinephrine.
An anaphylactic reaction can kill you.
Yes, it's deadly.
It can cause you.
And if there hadn't been epinephrine there, they probably would have died.
You can go into respiratory arrest when you have that kind of reaction.
Yes.
Is that a fair statement? So are the places where these vaccinations are being administered, or do they have the precautions in place to be sure that if somebody has an anaphylactic reaction, that there is a platform to immediately address that? So if I give a COVID vaccination at Walgreens, and somebody goes into anaphylactic shock and dies or goes into some type of anaphylactic reaction, what safety measures do I have in place for that person?
Yeah, well, that would really depend on where you got it. If you got it in a doctor's office, yes. But I mean, the other thing, the factor for us that I know from personal experience is, like at the clinic I worked at, when we would give the Gardasil vaccine, we would not let patients leave for 20 minutes because there was a 20-minute time period where we were going to see that reaction. So if you get a COVID vaccine at Walgreens and you're fine, so 60 seconds later, you're like, okay, I'm going to head home. And then you have an anaphylactic reaction in your car 4 minutes later, you're in trouble. But should they have epinephrine? Yes. does Walgreens? I'm not sure. I don't know if they do or not. I would imagine that they have epinephrine on hand, but I'm not sure.
The question I have is, are we asking pharmacists to be ER docs when something goes wrong in this situation? I mean, I don't know.
I would say, yeah,
ask a pharmacist to be able to identify an anaphylactic reaction and immediately administer epinephrine or whatever is needed. I don't think it's epinephrine.
Yeah, well, the concern, I think, would be you're giving a medication that you don't have a doctor's order to give. Like, right. In a clinical setting, for instance, if I was witnessing somebody have an anaphylactic reaction, I, as a medical assistant or an RN, whatever, you can't just give them epinephrine. That has to be ordered by a doctor, because just for legal purposes and stuff, like, it has to be ordered by a doctor.
Okay. All right, last question, and we're going to need to move on, but I just want to ask one more question. Before these before vaccinations are mandatory, what about the patient's personal medical history as it relates to possible comorbidities and their relationship with the vaccination you're giving them? Are there any attendant risks associated with people with comorbidities?
Are you talking specifically about the COVID vaccine?
Let's just use that one for example. So, like, the thing is, let's say I have a respiratory history. I'm on certain medication. I don't know if there's any contraindications for a specific vaccination. I know you're putting a chemical in my body, and I don't have a PDR that defines how that vaccination is going to react with the medications I'm presently on. So my concern is we're mixing chemicals where there are attendant risks, and it doesn't really seem to me that it's properly staffed for potential bad outcomes like anaphylactic shock, and mandating somebody to take that kind of risk. I have real questions about the reasonableness of forcing people to take that risk. So
exactly. Yeah. They're very blanketly given. Basically, unless you are like actively being treated with chemotherapy for cancer, that's pretty much the only thing I've ever seen hesitancy with vaccines. Otherwise, they're given blanketly just because it's a CDC recommendation. Everybody in that age bracket gets it.
Okay. Senator Yoakum, do you have a question?
I do. Yes, Senator. I would like to know, Senator, if Dr. Pedotti or anybody from public health is on this call and would like to respond to anything that was just said.
Maddie's on
there. I think we have Maddie Wilcox on the line.
Okay. I was hoping Pedotti was on, but okay.
Okay, who else?
Am I allowed to go ahead then, Senator Carlin?
Just for the sake of brevity, go ahead if you would.
Sure. I will be brief. I will share with you that I do have Dr. Pedotti on the line. And if I may, I'll go ahead and give my comments now in relation to the whole bill, and we'll go from there. So
I would like to hear Dr. Pedotti respond to all the things that Shonda just said. So.
Okay. Well, I hope you listened in on that line of questioning. If not, I can go over it again. But
I don't. It's necessary to repeat. Dr. Pedotti, I believe, is still on mute. Her name would be Caitlin Pedotti on here. If somebody on that end would be willing to unmute her.
Okay.
With a C?
Yeah. Yes, with a C. C-A-I-T.
There we go. I think we got her. Okay.
Yeah, hi. Thank you, Senator Yoakum, Senator Carlin, Senator Costello. Sure. It's nice to join you this afternoon. I think, Senator Carlin, you know, you've brought up a lot of very important, you know, and reasonable questions about how do we assure that the medications and vaccinations that we give are safe and effective, and they're very important questions. So I can try and be brief, and I would, as always, be happy to follow up afterwards if there's additional resources or information that I can provide for you, you know, as the state epidemiologist and as the public health medical director. And I can tell you, you know, as a pediatrician who's given these vaccines and ordered them, we do go through a lot of assessments about making sure that things that are given together are safe. We do a lot of monitoring, not just as these medications and vaccinations are in development, but after they've been developed, so that we can understand if there are rare or unusual circumstances that we need to know about or address. And so there are a lot of processes, as I think you've heard a couple of other people talk about, to help us keep track of and understand that data. It includes things like VAERS and VSAFE. It includes the vaccine information sheets that are provided for patients and also available online to be accessed at any time. And there is a variety of really good resources, I think, that can help people understand, you know, the impacts of, and benefits of these absolutely critical public health tools. I think you asked a bit about sort of how to compare these, sort of something like a physician's desk reference. You know, we've got, I think, some pharmacy partners on the line. And again, I think we'd be happy to follow up with additional resources and information. But often a lot of that information comes as part of a formulary for an institution, for a pharmacy, for a given, you know, clinical institution. And again, you're absolutely right. We want patients to work with their providers. We want them to understand, you know, the risks to themselves if they've got unusual health conditions or complex histories. But vaccines are very important. They're safe. They're critical life-saving tools. And I think, you know, there's good data to show that when you increase things like exemptions, people do take advantage of them, and it creates pockets of under-vaccinated or unvaccinated populations, which can lead to the spread of infectious diseases like measles, which is exactly what we saw in 2019. And of course, those come with their own sort of costs and, unfortunately, in some cases, death. So again, you know, happy to provide additional information and resources as an expert and resource for you all. And I'm sure Maddie and I can follow up if there's anything additional you'd like.
Well, so I guess here's my question. We all have a different medical history, and I have never seen anybody explain to me how somebody's medical history is taken into account before the decision to vaccinate them occurs.
Yeah, so when you come in to see me, or if you brought your child in to see me, I would ask questions about your allergies. I would ask about your underlying health conditions. I would ask what medications you take. And all of those things are important for me to understand, because there are some people who have what we call contraindications to vaccines. Now, thankfully, those are pretty rare, but it does include people who, for example, have had a true anaphylactic reaction to a vaccine in the past, or a component of a vaccine, for example. And so that discussion is important for people to continue to have, you know, with their healthcare providers. And it is something that, you know, we want to make sure people understand the resources. And of course, we want to make sure people understand, you know, how important it is to protect themselves against, you know, these diseases, which can lead to severe injury, disability, or death themselves.
Okay. So on the other side of that, I can tell you as a trial lawyer, I've seen people sustain some very debilitating injuries from the misplacement of a vaccination. I have a good friend who's a banker who's lost the use of his arm.
I'm so sorry.
I have another. So there are attendant risks associated with vaccinations. I don't think you deny that.
Absolutely, Senator. I'm so sorry to hear about that.
Yeah. Well, so, but when you reach the point where you're mandating something that could potentially harm somebody, if you could just kind of give me some of the balancing of interests that are considered when you're going to mandate something that could potentially harm somebody, and they really do have authentic concerns about the risks associated with it.
Yeah, you know, again, in terms of helping support you all in your decision making for situations like this, I think what's important to know is sort of the benefit and the impact of these really awful diseases that used to cause widespread disease and death. You know, it's remarkable that there are many of these illnesses that children used to die of routinely that I've never seen in my training at a top 10 pediatric program because of vaccines. So there's some great benefits that we've gotten, you know, as a society, not just life saving, but cost savings and resource savings, you know, to help protect people and preserve our healthcare resources for when we need them. And so, as a pediatrician, a public health professional, you know, I can tell you that vaccines continue to be a critical and remarkable life-saving tool that I think are incredibly important, you know, in helping keep people safe and healthy here.
You know, one of the divisions is for children and students. I'm going to take advantage of the fact that I have you here, okay? When I was a child, I only had a few vaccinations. As far as I know, at least my wife thinks I'm normal at this point. 3 or 4. We're now at 72. They're just as an observation, to me, the demographic incidence of significant presence of disease in children has risen exponentially to where I don't know if there's a correlation, but I'm doing the math in my head and I'm like thinking, why is chronic disease becoming increasingly significant in our population-based children? And what is the difference between when I was a kid and now? And, you know, I'm thinking, okay, I know that they get a lot more vaccinations now. You know, environmentally, I don't know what other things there are to consider. Is it the diet of Pop-Tarts? I mean, what is it?
No, it's a great reflection that you've just made, Senator. And I would say that what you've summarized represents an achievement in public health. The difference is we got good at developing new tools to fight diseases so that people don't have to suffer from them anymore. And so what you're left with are the conditions and diseases that we haven't yet developed those tools and solutions for. So I think what you see is that we did a good job and we can keep doing that.
Okay. Well, just when I was a kid, I don't think we had any autistic kids in my entire class. Now it's, I don't know what the actual numbers are, 1 in 10, 1 in 9. The autism numbers have exploded. And, you know, I know that's a classic argument and I get that, but I'm bringing it up just to have a conversation. So.
No, this is great. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate the chance to have such an important conversation, because you bring up a point that a lot of people need clarification on. There is absolutely no correlation between vaccination and autism. And I can tell you that with confidence as a pediatrician. But I appreciate what you're reflecting on, which is that there's been an increase. And I think there are reasons for that. I think in the past, we weren't as good at recognizing some of these conditions and providing supports and keeping track of them. I think that, you know, there are also things to consider like genetic and environmental factors. And again, you know, there's a bit of a challenge when you see two things kind of happen around the same time, that sometimes rather than just them being, you know, happening together, people can kind of worry about causation. And I think that some of what we've seen around the concerns around autism and vaccines, but again, Senator, I can confidently tell you there is no link between the two. And in fact, what we've been able to do is make really terrible diseases like smallpox and tetanus disappear.
I understand the smallpox argument. I mean, there's some diseases where I definitely see the need for a vaccination. But when you just said genetic and environmental factors, what you were saying is there's variation in genetic composition that might predispose some people to be more inclined to be injured as a result of a vaccination or die as a result.
Yeah, you know, there's always variation in us as individuals, absolutely.
So I got you here, so I'm going to pick your brain a little.
This is great.
So SIDS deaths.
Yeah.
There appears to be the timing of vaccinations and the incidence of SIDS death. 70% of SIDS deaths come after, I believe it's a pertussis, a whooping cough vaccination is present in 70% of those SIDS deaths. Any correlation there in your mind?
No, you know, and again, it's an important question and it is absolutely something that needs to be evaluated. And again, I fully support and believe in continuous safety evaluations for all of the tools that we have. And if we find new information or learn new things, that means we need to make different recommendations. We should always do that. But I think, again, what you're describing is that two things kind of happen together in time, but are not necessarily statistically related or causal. And I would be happy to follow up and provide you with some additional literature on that, because again, I think it's a really important thing to consider and to think through.
So along the lines, and I'm almost done with you, the incidence of chronic disease among children has gone up significantly since the 1980s. At the same time, it appears that the number of vaccinations has gone up as well. I'm not trying to play a devil's advocate here, but there's a lot more sick kids in the world today now than there was when I was a child by percentage.
So again, Senator, I think what we've seen is that they're sick with different things. You know, when my father grew up, he couldn't go to the swimming pool some summers because they were worried he'd get polio. And that's not something I've ever had to worry about, right? But instead, you know, my friends and colleagues worry about things like asthma or other chronic diseases. And you're right, when we get good at fighting the infectious diseases with the tools we have, what you're left with are the diseases that we don't have vaccines against.
But shouldn't we be moving the ball in the right direction?
Yes, I could not agree with you more, Senator. I would love to move the ball in the right direction on chronic diseases and all diseases. And that is such an important public health point. There's a lot of work to do to help, you know, our kids and all of us be healthier. And you're absolutely right. There's a lot of pieces and things to consider. And I would be happy to talk with you more about those.
Mark, do you have anything?
Well, maybe this is too direct of a question, but are you saying that formerly a lot of these people with these chronic diseases would have died with infectious diseases?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Not to make the point again, but if the vaccinations are an effective way of addressing these things, just globally, why are the number of children with chronic diseases growing? Because if they're growing, that means we're going in the wrong direction. They should be shrinking. I mean, because we're giving them all these vaccinations, and I just don't know why the problem appears to be getting worse.
Yeah, so again, the causes for things like obesity or other, you know, chronic health conditions, they're different, right? There are different social and environmental causes that have to be, unfortunately, addressed differently. In fact, they're much harder to solve. They're much more complicated than our infectious diseases, where we have the opportunity of using things like vaccines to sort of provide a one-stop shop so that, you know, I get my HPV shot and I never have to worry about that again. But unfortunately, focusing on healthy diet, exercise, all of those things are the more complicated, more challenging problems that we're left with. And it's precisely because we've done such a good job at innovating technologies and tools on the infectious side, which is what we've seen over the past year. The fact that we, you know, identified a disease and produced a vaccine for a new infectious disease in a year is absolutely remarkable. And so the use of these tools and technologies to address other problems, maybe chronic problems in the future, would be really important, because you're right, there are a lot of public health issues left to tackle.
So last question, maybe one tiny follow-up. As far as like the COVID vaccination, have we looked at the effects on fertility, pregnant moms? Have we looked at the effects on seniors?
Yeah.
What are the risk groups there, and what are the attendant risks associated with those demographics?
Great questions. Very important questions. And again, like all of the vaccines, medications, and healthcare sort of interventions that we have, these things are always under evaluation. So the trials that were done to help bring the two vaccines we have in the United States, the Moderna and Pfizer, to market, did look for side effects. And for the most part, what we get reports of so far are what we call localized side effects. So maybe some redness, you know, maybe a little bit of fatigue, you know, after a vaccine. There have been, unfortunately, some reports of more severe allergic reactions in people who have had a previous allergic reaction to one of the ingredients in the vaccines. And so, again, that's exactly why it's important that people work with their providers to understand that and share that information. But the evaluation of these vaccines is not over, and it shouldn't be. That's exactly why we have VAERS and VSAFE, so that we can continue to learn more about the impact of these vaccines on the populations that you've just mentioned, and all of us, including kids who we have yet to see, you know, a pediatric vaccine for this, which will be very important as well. So what I can say is, you know, right now, there are no specific sort of concerns or contraindications for the groups that you mentioned, but it is critical that we continue to evaluate that. And we do it by having systems in place like theirs and be safe.
Thank you, Dr. Padotti.
Absolutely. If there's anything additional I can provide, please let Maddie or I know.
Very good. I don't know if Senator Yoakum has any follow-up.
Okay. No, I just really appreciate the fact that we gave Dr. Padotti a chance to communicate her thoughts with the committee. So thank you, Dr. Padotti. Thank you, Senator Carlin.
Thank you, Senators.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Sharon Guthrie. Sharon?
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to have an opportunity to make some comments. I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner by education, and the executive director of the Iowa School Nurse Organization. Have been in leadership of school nursing in Iowa for 20 years. As I look at the bill, there's a lot of areas of concern. One of, in particular, and out of respect of the other comments that are made, by all means, we want kids to grow up to be healthy and as safe as possible. And in terms of the comments about getting removed from some medical practices because you won't vaccinate your children, I would say then we should be working with those practices to help them understand why they want to keep you as a patient instead of just blanketly taking away the expectation to have immunizations. You know, when kids get cancer, I mean, I think about my neighbor girl who had cancer and she didn't choose to get cancer, but yet if she goes to school and parents choose not to have their kids immunized, she is at risk and is the one who doesn't suffers potentially life-threatening illnesses. I also think that we have a religious exemption already, which many parents will use already, and that works. So we should use it if as needed, as it has been. I think a lot of the chronic illness questions that you were asking, as Dr. Padotti addressed, come from so many other things, such as access to food, lack of exercise, pollution, environmental concerns that we also need to take into consideration with chronic conditions. I also want to address division number 6, in which the registering the immunizations in the IRIS, the Iowa registry, and needing that consent. And while I believe that all parents should have the right to determine what happens with my health information, I also believe that if we're going to provide the best healthcare in Iowa, that if my child goes to the ER because they were cut on something, that I want every provider to know if their immunizations are current and up to date so that they can treat them appropriately and give them a tetanus shot if they need it. So I think there's the bill really opens up opportunities for a lot more chronic diseases. And I can't imagine if we have a pandemic with COVID and then add in measles and pertussis on top of that, because that will be a disaster. Thank you.
Thank you. Maddie Wilcox.
Thank you, Senator Carlin. And thank you to the members of the subcommittee for giving some great time for Dr. Padotti to share the background and some of the additional science and medical background related to this issue. I will not be as eloquent on that, but I do want to share just a little bit about the fiscal impact, which I know is also of concern to the state. So just so you all know, between Division 3 and Division 4 of the bill, the state general fund for this particular appropriation for infectious disease will need an additional $82,500 for fiscal year 2022. So that will account for the contractual expenses for upgrading IRIS to accommodate the changes made in this bill. Dr. Padotti did speak to this, but the bill would directly impact the number of children attending school and child care who are fully immunized. You know, we know that states with lower immunization rates have higher rates of disease. And changing that in Division 6, then changing that functionality of IRIS to maintain that individual parent written consent, those pieces. Sharon Guthrie kind of spoke to that piece as well, so I'll let those comments stand. One additional piece that I feel it's important for you all to know, besides the direct fiscal impact that would be anticipated due to upgrades to IRIS, I wanted to share with you the indirect financial impact of the bill if this were to be implemented in Iowa. If Iowa were to have a disease outbreak.
In 2004, Iowa had a disease outbreak, and Iowa spent $142,000 and almost $142.5 on that to contain a single case of measles. So that's one case of measles. And in 2004, that's what it cost. As you can imagine, we would anticipate an increase of cost just due to inflation rates. The other a more recent case that I wanted to highlight for you is in 2017, there was an outbreak of measles in Minnesota, so our neighbor to the north there, and that had 79 cases. 71 of the cases were unvaccinated, or of the population were unvaccinated for measles. So only 8 of those folks were vaccinated, but the majority of those people who caused that large outbreak were not vaccinated. That cost our neighbors to the north $1.3 million. And I don't share these numbers lightly. I know that everyone in the state is, cares about the health of Iowans as well as the balance checkbook. So I'm happy to provide additional information and follow up with you all after the subcommittee. Certainly there's others happy to speak. And again, Dr. Badati did a phenomenal job of explaining the position of the department related to concerns if people were to have vaccine hesitancy. Thank you very much, senators.
If you don't mind, Maddie, I just want to ask you a couple questions. Division 5 prohibiting the connection of vaccination or immunity status to a state-issued driver's license. Do you have any issue with that?
Division 5, I don't believe, has an impact to us specifically as a department. I'll make sure to follow up and confirm that. But again, the portions that would most impact us would be Divisions 3, Divisions 4, and Division 6.
What about Division 6, just the registry of the vaccinations that you've received?
Yep. So, IRIS is a secure computerized repository for all of this vaccine information. And, some of our concerns are, failure to maintain a robust immunization registry may result in the over and under immunization of Iowans. Again, we've got a centralized database system, and if folks can't remember if they did or didn't receive a vaccine but are interested in receiving a vaccine, that's a resource for medical professionals who provide vaccine. And so again, certainly we don't want to be over immunizing anybody because that can have risks as well. And so I think that's part of this too, is by having a comprehensive database that, those are some of our concerns related to Division 6. We haven't, directly impacting the number of immunized children, as I stated earlier, that does bring about a concern for us.
Okay, so right now, is that something that you have to get an informed consent form from a patient to have their medical information stored, or is that something that's done automatically?
So that would be something that's done automatically. Part of the process of, and I guess I want to clarify kind of the two separate. So just to be clear, because I think we've got two different issues going on. There's kind of the regular occurring scheduled vaccines, and then there are the vaccines related to COVID. And so this is something that a doctor can opt into, putting the information on IRIS related to the maybe standardized traditional vaccines, I guess is the word I'm going to go with for right now. But it is not optional for any medical provider who is providing COVID vaccine. Those all have to be entered onto IRIS within 24 hours. So I just want to clarify, because I think there's kind of two separate issues that are happening right now. And again, happy to provide that additional clarity on that. But that's where those spaces differ.
So here's where I'm going with that. And I guess this is what concerns me. So are we going to create a database that could effectively shut people out from traveling in an airplane, being given health care, being able to attend a university? I mean, where are we going with this? So for the people that don't want to have these vaccinations, are we going to summarily start excluding everybody who doesn't get the vaccinations? That's what I'm really concerned about.
So I certainly appreciate those concerns, Senator Carlin. This is something that the medical professionals have access to as providers.
Anybody else?
But And like parents, you know, parents or the actual patient themselves, this isn't something that like your just average employer could log on and see what vaccines, for instance, I have or have not received. That wouldn't be something that an employer has access to, from my understanding.
Have you had any so an employer couldn't refer to a database to make sure? So like as a lawyer, I have a database of everybody in the state who's ever been charged with a crime, and I can look it up. I guess what I'm concerned about is like an airline, you know, pulling you up on a database. No, you haven't had the vaccination, you can't board the plane. There's some airlines right now that are already doing that, that they're already going in that direction. I don't want this to be used as some kind of enormous platform for government overreach to define this one portion of someone's healthcare and then what comes after that. That's the path that I'm concerned about.
Certainly. So I appreciate that. What I will share is to kind of specifically speak to the airline piece, airlines do not have access to IRIS. So I want to kind of just identify that really quickly. I think any piece that maybe an airline would be having would be printed off materials or individual provided by the individual flyer, but wouldn't be something that the department would be called upon to ask or to provide or anything like that from the state perspective.
Sorry, Manny.
That's all right, Senator Costa. So I guess that's just, again, it's really about those certain people having access, and certainly welcome the conversation related to data governance and data confidentiality. I know that's something that the House has been very diligently working on, and that's something that the Department of Public Health is determined to be a partner on. So I think maybe a broader conversation around data confidentiality, we certainly appreciate that. Please know that everybody within the department who has access to any kind of data goes through a thorough data confidentiality training. And know that that's always our intent, as well as medical providers are held to HIPAA standards, which is federal. And so I guess I want to clarify that piece related to data confidentiality. And if you're interested in having a further conversation around that, I'm happy to do so.
I would appreciate that very much. Do you know how many vaccinations are on the child student mandate list? How many right now presently do we have?
I apologize, Senator. I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I'm happy to follow up with you on that.
Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Looks like we have Andy Conlon.
Good afternoon, Senators. I just wanted to start some video here. I'll be brief. I'm here on behalf of Bleeding Age Iowa. We're a statewide membership organization, nonprofit providers of aging services and support. Our membership supports about 25,000 Iowans every day. We're concerned about the provisions in this bill, primarily divisions 1 and 2 relating to vaccines as a condition of employment. Our big concern is we serve vulnerable people. Not all employers choose to require vaccination, but it's certainly a tool in the toolbox. Right now, just as a point of information, we don't know of any of our members who are mandating the use of COVID vaccine while it's an emergency use authorization status. However, we know some folks are thinking about it at all stages of traditional FDA approval. So we're in a little bit of a wait and see mode on that, but we do oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask Andy a question?
Andy, we got one more question for you before you take off.
So, Andy, if they do decide to require the vaccine, what will they use as verification that that employee has been vaccinated?
At this point, I would just be speculating without speaking to our members and the folks who are kind of in the front lines on this. I do know that folks who are getting the COVID vaccine get the small sheets for their first and second doses. But again, without having talked to our folks, I would just be speculating.
Okay.
But I'd be happy to find that out for you, Senator.
All right. Yeah.
No, I would like to know how that's documented.
I'm happy to reach out to our members.
Thank you. Looks like we have Bethany. I don't know what Bethany's last name is.
Hi, my name is Bethany Niermeyer. I am speaking as a concerned citizen from Cedar Rapids. I just wanted to branch off of what Shanda said earlier about Section 2. My son had a stroke after his 2-month vaccines, which caused permanent brain damage and cost him the vision in his left eye. It does happen. And to branch off of what Dr. Padotti mentioned, that those who have vaccine injuries should continue to speak with their healthcare providers about their choices. How are we supposed to do that when they won't see us to begin with? I have to drive 2 hours for my son to be seen by a doctor because even with him having a medical exemption due to that vaccine injury, no doctor in the Cedar Rapids area will see him because the exemption wasn't written by their office specifically, and I refuse to continue vaccinating him and putting his health at risk. I went to 6 different doctors before I finally found one that believed me enough on what happened to my son because his original doctor did not even believe me and refused to record it in his medical records or report it to VAERS. Thankfully, I was able to get him that medical exemption. Every single person in the state of Iowa should have the opportunity to make informed decisions about their health without concern of losing their doctor, their job, or their health insurance. Vaccines are not a one-size-fits-all. My son is a great example of that, and I know he's not alone. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm very sorry to hear that. Lindsay Marr.
Mayor.
All right. Thank you, Senators, for allowing me to speak today. I just wanted to touch on a couple of things that I don't know if actually got answered prior to. I was looking at the New England Journal of Medicine. The trials were actually published for the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines in those papers. They went over what comorbidities were actually studied, and they mentioned that there are significant gaps in data on whether or not this is safe or effective for those over the age of 70, pregnant women, and children. The comorbidities that they did look at were included in 21% of the trial participants, despite the fact that Iowa has well over 1.8 million people with a chronic illness. 40% of our state actually has 2 chronic illnesses. The chronic illnesses that they did study were related to cancer, diabetes, various forms of cancer, lymphoma, leukemia, liver disorders, and peptic ulcer disease. That was in the Pfizer vaccination, as well as renal disease and rheumatic disease. The biggest challenge with those is that they are in single numbers, meaning a lot of them, like for instance, dementia, only had 7 people evaluated. Others included like the myocardial infarction, 194, renal disease, 123. So what happens with trials is we have a tyranny of small numbers. And when you don't have a large enough trial size for those specific comorbidities, you're going to miss the reactions that do occur. In addition to that we have major concerns with the mRNA-based platform. There have been multiple scientists speaking out about this. In Nature's Review, January 2018, the new era in vaccinology is mRNA. They talked about how there's been an associated link with inflammation and potentially inducing new autoimmune conditions. There were very rarely, if any, autoimmune conditions studied during this trial. The Pfizer vaccine had 43,000 participants. The Moderna vaccine had 30,000 participants. Again, if the adverse events are 1 in 1,000, which we saw with Bell's palsy, they were 1 in 10,000. But if you're going to miss the adverse reactions if you do not have a large enough sample trial. And that was stated last year at the WHO Global Vaccine Summit by Dr. David Caslow, who's the VP of Essential Medicines Drug Development Program PATH Center for Vaccine Innovation and Access. He said, and I quote, "So in our clinical trials, we are actually using relatively small sample sizes. And when we do that, we're at a risk of tyranny of small numbers. Getting the right size, dealing with the tyranny of small numbers, making sure that you can really do it." And so I think one of the things that we really need to invest in are better biomarkers, better mechanistic understanding of how these things work, so we can better understand adverse events as they come up. So in essence, we don't actually have a full understanding of the mechanism revolving around adverse events. And while they say we have these programs set up like VAERS and VSAFE, I would beg to differ in the fact that less than 1% of reactions are reported, according to a 2011 Harvard study commissioned by HHS, by Dr. Ross Lazarus, and the fact that the Institute of Medicine has repeatedly repeatedly asked for more studies to be done on safety. In 2013, they stated in the adverse events report, there has not been a study done to compare the health outcomes between unimmunized and immunized children. Furthermore, studies to examine long-term safety effects of the entire schedule have not been conducted. In 2011, they looked at 155 adverse events, adverse event conditions. 86% of them, 135, did not have enough data to formally make a statement as accepting causation or rejecting causation by the vaccinations they studied. So unfortunately, our regulatory agencies are not doing an adequate job. The FDA's—
Can I stop there? Yeah. I just have a question.
Sure.
So in that number of adverse reactions, do you know how big the sample size was from the total number of people who were involved? So like, in terms of statistical probability of bad outcomes, what are we looking at?
Well, in the 2011 Dr. Ross Lazarus study, he studied 1.4 million doses and almost 750,000 patient records, and he found 2.6% of doses administered caused an adverse event. And again, only 1% or less were reported.
So, I mean, when you talk about adverse events, are we talking about a headache? Are we talking, I mean, you mentioned several of them, but like, what is the least serious? You know, like, you could have 100,000 people get a headache, you can get stuck on the internet, as that. You know, it's the people with the serious.
Yeah.
Those people.
So my background is actually in virology. I have a graduate degree from the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine regarding viral glycoprotein entry, mechanism of study, how a virus actually interacts with the cell and infects it. I don't necessarily have the clinical experience, but in these reactions that we're seeing, it could be something mild, like a fever, malaise, but it could be severe, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, type 1, mental or nervous disorders, ADD, ADHD. All of these are listed on the vaccine inserts and in the clinical trial studies. They just aren't necessarily reported in broad numbers to the general public in the vaccine information statements.
Continue. Did you have anything else, Max?
Yeah, the other thing I wanted to address was the fact that we're hearing a lot about vaccine hesitancy being an issue. And I've got 10 years of morbidity and mortality weekly reports from the CDC with the vaccination rates of every state, as well as the exemption rates. And I'm failing to see, I guess, where the correlation lies with the public health department, because Iowa has a very high vaccination rate for the three that they track, MMR, DTaP, and varicella, at 93.3%. Our exemption rate was at 2% in 2018. States comparable in size and location, Arkansas and Oklahoma, they have all three of the exemptions listed that are outlined in this bill, and they have similar vaccination rates, 94.2%, 93%, 93.8%, and exemption rates of 1.8%. So adding another exemption does not necessarily mean we are going to increase the amount of people not vaccinating with those core school vaccinations. Additionally, Dr. Daniel Salmon for the Institute for Vaccine Safety at Johns Hopkins revealed that the majority of exempt students receive some vaccines. So it's not all or nothing. If an exemption exists, it does not mean that child is 100% unvaccinated. It might just mean they didn't want to do all of the ones on the CDC schedule or on the required school schedule. So I really think we need to take a better look at looking at needs-based medicine. We're talking about blanket, one-size-fits-all programs, when in reality, we need to be focused on the individual, our kids, our personal health. Needs-based medicine needs to be more implemented in our vaccination program in order to have better health outcomes. Not every child needs to probably have all of the vaccines on that schedule. Some of them are, yes, very effective, and no one's here to argue that we want to get rid of vaccinations. We just want to give parents and individuals the right to choose whether or not it's going to be good for them. So force does not improve trust. So I'm not sure why mandates and coercion would do anything to improve the not only the visibility, but the respect and trust of our healthcare programs, let alone our government.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Katie, did you have a question?
Lindsay, do you know off the top of your head what is on the schedule for school vaccinations? Or is that something that you'd have to look up?
You're on mute. Lindsay, you're on mute.
Okay, here we go. Better?
Yeah.
I can pull it up here. I've got it in my folders right next to me if you give me a minute.
Okay, we could probably come back. Can we come back to her?
Yeah.
Let's go to Katie and we'll come back to Lindsay.
Hi, good afternoon, Senators. Thank you. So I'm going to be speaking more about the employer-employee side of this, piggybacking off of all of the lack of safety studies that are available that Lindsay just laid out for us. I want to assure everyone here that this is not about vaccine hesitancy. This is about protecting Iowans. Iowans do not have protection at this time. There are many reasons why an individual would opt out of getting a vaccine, some vaccines, or all vaccines. And like Lindsay mentioned, most of them are only using an exemption for one or a few. Religious and conscientious beliefs, sure, but certainly a person's medical and biological makeup. These individuals are being discriminated against. We're seeing them being kicked out of medical clinics. Now we have the concern coming in of losing jobs, not being able to travel, et cetera, unless they are compliant with the vaccine requirements laid out. And I want to make the point that a person's religious belief, a person's medical makeup, their biological makeup is something that is out of their control. This is intrinsic to them. These people need protection. And if the Constitution is no longer enough to protect these rights, we need to start writing and passing policy that will. Over the past year, we've seen private businesses turned into public health police. They are being made to police policies that they were never meant to and are not equipped to enforce. We have Iowa businesses that are no longer free to carry business as they see fit. They are no longer allowed to respect their customers' individual choice. And we've already seen the reporting hotline go up for businesses that were not enforcing mask mandates to the fullest extent. How long until we are in the same position regarding the vaccine? Iowans deserve to continue employment without forgoing their constitutionally protected rights. The 14th Amendment protects the right to autonomy. Certainly that covers what is or is not injected into a person's body. The question that arises in my mind is it capitalism now to coerce employees into a procedure under the guise of free enterprise, even if doing so trumps a person's right to autonomy? Please push this through and protect Iowans. Protect human dignity and autonomy. Thank you.
Okay. I in the interest of time, I would like to limit comments from this point on to 3 minutes. If that's okay with everybody. I know everybody wants to be heard. Looks like we've got 6 more to go. Thank you, Katie, very much. Do you have that information, Lindsay? Need to unmute you.
I was not able to find it right offhand, but I will get that to you.
Thank you very much. Peter Wallace.
Thank you. I'm Peter Wallace. I'm a pediatrician from Iowa City, and I have been for 45 years specializing in my career in immunization. In fact, I was part of a small group back in the 70s and 80s that under another legislature got the school entry immunization bill passed. There are several things that I could comment on. During that time, we had a lot of problem with other states telling us about the concern with personal exemption, which was so severe in eliminating kids from immunization that many of the states that passed it have unpassed it, have reversed it because of the huge number of people that just said, I don't want anybody to give my kid a shot. The second aspect which has come up, which I want to comment on, is the vaccine compensation legislation. I, again, was part of a group in Washington, D.C. in the early 80s that was concerned about the number of frivolous lawsuits against our vaccine manufacturers, which were driving them out of business and threatening the very presence of vaccines. We passed a law, and I personally worked with Senator Grassley who was in charge of seeing the law through the Judiciary Committee, visited with him 10 or 12 times in Washington, that set up two things. One was an independent 9-member expert panel of scientists familiar with immunizations and their reactions to adjudicate any problem that a parent or a family, this was not just childhood immunizations, this was adult, they could come and present their case, because the second part of the bill set up a compensation system. This compensation system could be adjudicated by this panel, and the people who were injured or their child or a family member injured could be given adequate compensation. This was financed by a surcharge on the vaccines that were manufactured in this country, and those of us in practice had to double and triple our vaccine cost to our patients, unfortunately, but it has worked. And several people have mentioned problems. I can't remember, I think it was Bethany had the injured child. And this mechanism is open to the entire public and has been remarkably effective. And I'd like to be sure that everybody listening understands that. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you wish. Thank you for the time, Senators.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Peter. Pramod Dwivedi.
Yes, Pramod Dwivedi. I'm a health director at Linn County Public Health in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And I have followed no other profession but public health all my life. And, you know, the critical component, as we have heard from numerous speakers, critical component of public health intervention is indeed immunization, vaccination, and that has saved countless lives across this world. Think about, you know, polio. We don't see it here in this country, but there are countries, places where we still have polio and the devastation that you see. So public health is not just about public's health. It's also about economy as well. So if we don't have a healthy population, we cannot really improve or enhance our economy. So immunization is really, it's not only saves lives, it also saves money as well, and a lot of other things. There are other issues that you all talked about, chronic diseases. I mean, chronic disease basically is the function of our, largely, I would say, function of our lifestyle, social determinants of health. And as elected officials, I think I would challenge you all to look at those aspects where we can change our behavior, where we can create an environment where people are much more active. They are eating the right kind of food. You know, we have food desert in our communities across this state. We can do a lot more. But I think this would be very irresponsible in my mind if this bill were to pass, because this would really devastate. We are lucky that we have resources in this country, and we work very closely with our scientific community, but I think this would be a very irresponsible action, as far as I can tell you, as a public health practitioner myself. You know, that the thing is that there are certain exemptions based on medical issues, medical problems. We are not opposing to that. I mean, there are reasons that people should get those types of exemptions, but we must continue on the path of immunization. We have, you know, in epidemiology, we have a term called herd immunity. There are diseases, if we go down that threshold, then we'll see outbreaks. We saw that in case of measles in California and other places. So So I think our state needs to be progressive. We have outstanding, you know, scientific community here, amazing College of Public Health, College of Medicine. We can talk to those guys as well as and public health practitioners. You had Dr. Pedati from IDPH, and you have lowly people like us in different local health departments who constantly work to continue to improve public health. So I urge you, strongly urge you, beg you to please look at the science. There are reactions, there are cases where people get injured, but that's very, very, very rare. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Doctor. Emily Lewis.
Hello. I am getting on as a concerned citizen, and I'm also the parent of a vaccine injured child. I have a few things I want to say about this bill. My husband and I both support this bill strongly. Employers should not be able to mandate vaccines as they are not 100% safe. We have a child that is already vaccine injured. My husband should not have to choose between his job and keeping himself safe. We have been kicked out of a doctor's office after my son was injured. And I know that for a fact that they kicked several other families out of their practice the same time that they kicked ours out. Thankfully, we were able to find a doctor that would take us on and respected our choices. We have had to pull our son from services at ChildServe because he won't wear a mask or a shield, which I know this bill is not about that. But what's to stop them from kicking other kids out or not allowing them into the building because of their vaccination status? The cost of treating our son's issues that he has now have been astronomical. We won't ever see a dime from that compensation program that doctor spoke of. And the families that do go through that, they're scrutinized the entire time that they're going through it. And most of them don't see a dime from it. So yeah, like Vayers, we were never told about that when this happened to our son, even by the doctor that would take us on. Like, I don't know if she didn't know about it, which I'm finding that most doctors and nurses don't know about and don't care to tell their patients about, and they don't report anything to it. So when we did find out about it, we were a week past the limit of being able to report anything to it and being able to do anything about it. So when people say stuff about Vayers, it's a load of crap. Like, it does nothing, especially when doctors are refusing to say anything to their patients about it. And when they come back and say, there's something wrong with my child the week after they got these vaccines, and they are just sitting there saying, no, there's nothing wrong with your child, and it has nothing to do with the vaccines. So I'm sick and tired of hearing about Vayers from medical professionals when it's not used. Like, it's ridiculous. And to sit here and deny this bill and say that it's not worth doing, is my child not worth it? Like, are people's lives not worth it? I don't want to see my husband injured and not be able to work because he has to take a COVID vaccine to go into a business that he's supposed to be going into work at. How is that fair to us?
Thank you. We have Amy Campbell. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Senator. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm on life support on my battery here, so I'll be very brief. I have a number of organizations that I represent that are opposed to this bill, including the Nurses Association, Primary Care Association, Behavioral Health Association, but I really wanted to talk from the perspective of Lutheran Services in Iowa and the other providers like them that serve people with disabilities. You know, when you choose to work in a facility that cares for vulnerable individuals, you have to understand that you too also have to make sure that you protect them. And so we are opposed to this bill. I just want to remind you, I have a friend, or not a remind you, tell you a story about my friend who has an adult son with Down syndrome. People with Down syndrome are 10 times more likely to die from COVID. They have other health risks involved that put them at risk, even with the flu. And to tell a family member that an unprotected, unvaccinated person is going to be caring for their loved one, you really have to look at it from that parent's perspective as well. So I would encourage you to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Is there any portion of this bill, Amy, that you think is okay? Any division of this bill? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but...
Well, so my computer died right now too, so I have nothing, but I don't have the bill in front of me, but I as far as my clients and our conversations, no.
Right. Okay. Because I mean, there has to be a balancing of interests on provisions and divisions of the bill. And authentically consider the interests of both sides of the issue. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that. Well, I've got you. Thank you, Amy. Ashley Lynn.
Hi. Thanks for unmuting me. I'm Ashley. I'm a registered nurse here in Iowa, and I'm also a mother of four. I don't know, nobody mentioned about how the clinical trials for the COVID vaccine are now recruiting children as young as 6 months old. Thankfully, COVID has had a pretty negligent effect on children. Over 80% of our 5,200 deaths here in Iowa have been in those 70 years old or older. If COVID vaccines do get approved for children and the schools start to require them, they'll continue to be liability-free for the company when it comes to injury or death, just as they are right now under the emergency use approval. Parents should absolutely have an option to opt out. We are talking about a vaccine, in all vaccines actually, given to healthy children, and in this particular instance, they're not even really affected by this virus. Bloomberg actually just reported in December that people are leaving states that have more controlling governments, including with vaccines, such as California, New York, and Illinois. The places seeing an increase in migration are Texas and Arizona, which are two freedom-loving states that also happen to have all three vaccine exemptions. When we look at the states with no non-medical exemptions and see their high vaccine rates, it appears to be because people leave to a state that gives them choice, not because they comply. I think that if the public health officials are concerned about geographical pockets of unvaccinated individuals, they should allow freedom to choose instead of taking away the choice and forcing those pockets to form. When it comes to employee mandates, I think there's a thought that flocks of completely unvaccinated individuals are going to take over healthcare positions. And I have to kind of laugh because I don't think that'll ever happen considering what the professionals stand for. But if it ever did get to that point, we should probably reevaluate our vaccine recommendations then. This bill is to protect individual rights and bodily autonomy, which for some reason over the past year seems to be frowned upon. The COVID vaccine already has a high refusal amongst healthcare workers. Walgreens reported 60% of nursing home staff refused the COVID vaccine when it was offered, and 20% of nursing home residents did. The CDC also released information 2 weeks ago mimicking that data to say 22% of nursing home residents refused the vaccine and 70% of the nursing home staff refused it. Roughly, 80% of general healthcare providers have agreed to take the vaccine across the nation. This says to me that healthcare personnel want the right to their own bodily autonomy because at this point in 2021, we all know the risk associated with COVID. People should not have to be strong-armed into doing what others think is best for everyone to have a job, go to school, enter an airplane, or cross state lines. There should not be discrimination against those who decide the risk of the unknowns with the vaccine do not outweigh the knowns of the virus when it comes to themselves and their children. I urge you to please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley. Representative Shipley.
Thank you, Senator Carlin and Senator Costello and Senator Yoakam. Just a real brief comment, kind of hypothetical one. Just, I think, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a very interesting area of the law that could use a lot more definitions. So hopefully this would help accomplish that. Just the one question I'm really wanting clarification on, and I don't know if any of the business or industry groups could speak to this, but reviewing the EEOC guidance on this topic and then reviewing the existing Iowa code as it pertains to religious protections, I was just very curious, what is the current protocol for in the healthcare setting if someone comes forward and says, I have a religious objection to getting the flu immunization? And then if the response is to actually terminate that employee, how does that square with the current Civil Rights Act that we have? So there's just some, I guess, clarification questions I'm very interested in terms of how these industry groups and stakeholders are currently addressing the situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Looks like we have Amy Schreiber. You're muted, Amy.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Awesome. Well, hi. Thank you guys for unmuting me and allowing me to talk. Hi, Senator Costello. So as some of you know, I'm a pediatrician that works here in Des Moines. I take care of children ages 0 through 18, 19, 20, 21. I do have patients in my practice who have decided not to vaccinate, and I still respect that and see them and take the very best care of them that I can. I am very much a proponent of maintaining our standards of vaccination safety and efficacy and maintaining our current vaccination laws. As a pediatrician, I'm very concerned about laws that allow for philosophical exemptions. It has a dramatic effect on the way people make decisions about their own healthcare in terms of instilling more fear and letting that fear overcome the medical facts that we have about vaccine safety and efficacy. And we do know that without very strong recommendations, we're going to see a lot more people not vaccinate their children. All children are vulnerable starting at birth. And when we use the CDC recommended vaccination schedule, we're doing that to protect them against serious illnesses that could potentially kill them in the first year of their life. We continue to provide vaccinations to help keep them safe, and then to protect those who, due to medical reasons, such as undergoing chemotherapy, cancer, if you're immunocompromised and you're unable to get your vaccines, then we rely on other people to do that, to get their vaccines to protect others. So if we allow philosophical exemptions, we'll start to see numbers drop, and that will increase the prevalence of some of these very dangerous some of these very dangerous illnesses in our communities. So we'll start seeing more kids getting meningitis, more kids getting serious pneumonias, and more like having more people in our emergency rooms and in our PICUs and NICUs. So I'm hoping that we can continue our highest quality standards for children's health care. I'm hoping that the decision makers will rely on medical expert testimony and understand that public health is so important for Iowa. So I'm happy to be a resource to you if you need any further answers to any questions about immunizing kids in a pediatric clinic here in this area. So thanks very much. And know that I care about each and every one of those kids that were mentioned today, and that I care about every kid that comes into my clinic, and I want them all to be safe and happy and healthy.
Thank you, Dr. Schreiber. We may very well take you up on that. I might have a couple follow-up questions. If you could send an email to myself, Senator Costello, and Senator Yoakam with an email address to direct further inquiries to you, and I'd appreciate that.
I'd be very happy to. Thank you for the opportunity.
Senator Guth.
There we go. Almost too complex for me to figure out here. Just a brief comment. We've heard a lot of testimony already. One thing, especially in regard to the COVID vaccine, that I think we need to keep in mind if we're talking about mandates for employers is, first, is that the COVID vaccine does not keep you from getting COVID, and that the vaccine will not stop transmission of COVID. So it doesn't make any sense to try and mandate something, especially if an employee has already had COVID. Then they're going to have immunity. But if the vaccine doesn't keep you from getting it, it keeps you from having symptoms, but it does not keep you from having COVID itself. And if it does not stop transmission, it doesn't make any sense for us to be trying to mandate with the idea that we're going to keep from passing it around. So plenty of other things that I could talk about, but I'll let other people do that. Thank you.
Jessica.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for the chance just to make a couple comments. I appreciate the discussion that we've had today. And I think just one thing I would like to say, my members are, some of my members are the companies that are developing these vaccines. And we're happy to be a resource as far as information about the different types of vaccines, about clinical trials. And also just, we are, our national affiliate Bio has also submitted comments, and they're a great resource of information as well. So if you do have questions specific to vaccine development, I'd be happy to try to get you information on those topics. So just wanted to raise my hand and say I am a resource here from the science perspective, from our member perspective. And we do oppose the legislation, but we are happy to be a resource to you as you are deliberating. Thank you.
Thank you. Like the last person we have today is Annette Ava.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I am asking you to support this bill. In our household, we are full of immune compromised and have children with multiple autoimmune diseases. And so we have to diligently watch every ingredient that goes into and onto their bodies. And so we have to decide what's the risk and versus the benefit of a product if we can't find a substitute for that product, which also includes like pharmaceutical drugs. If their doctor prescribes them a drug, we have to go and look at all the ingredients for that drug to see if they can actually take it. The doctor doesn't know what those ingredients are. So we would ask that we have the choice of what we put in our bodies, not only food products, but also medical products. We are the ones that have to live with that risk versus the benefit. No one else is going to stand up for us. No one else is going to pay our medical bills. No one else is going to come and take care of us when we're physically damaged. So I'm asking that you would support this bill for medical freedom. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Yoakum, do you have any questions or comments? I don't think she's with us.
No,
she there?
I thought it was. Is that somebody else?
She
might
have left.
She's with Liz there.
There's Liz.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you unmute her? Can you unmute yourself?
Yep, we just did. So my computer actually died. I've been on Zoom since 11 this morning. Anyway, thank you to all of you that spoke for and against the bill. And thank you for Liz for letting me jump on her computer. I certainly am not in a position where I want to sign off on this bill. I understand the great need to balance the rights of people with the right of trying to make sure we keep everybody healthy through a public health system, especially in the midst of a pandemic. I don't believe this bill is the answer to the issues before us. But thank you to all who participated today.
Senator Costello.
I don't think I have any more questions at this time. Just some of my thoughts. I mean, this is a difficult bill because, you know, I can definitely see both sides of it. I think there are some things in the bill that I do definitely want to do. There may be some things that we might change. I think I'm going to sign off on the bill to keep the discussion going, and maybe we'll get a bill that we can feel more comfortable with overall. But I think I'll go ahead and help sign it out of committee if that's okay. Senator Carlin's desire.
Okay. I am respectful of both sides of this issue. I too would like to continue the conversation and see what maybe what things would be appropriate in the balancing of these interests to be respectful of both sides. I don't think I can agree to a wholesale position that all of the provisions in this bill are unreasonable or not needed. I can recognize some legitimate concerns here that so I am going to sign off on it, and I want some time to think about it, and I want to see if some of these provisions could go forward in a bill. So
one thing I wanted to comment, Senator Cron, I've received a very large number of emails in support of this bill, and mostly just from the lobbyists on the other side, which is okay. I know you represent a lot of people too. But so it is very, very many people feel strongly about it, and we want to acknowledge that as well.
Yeah, we have received many, many emails, and I still am somewhat unsatisfied with, and this was brought up, treating people as individuals rather than taking a broad brush without more and better information. I am concerned that you could mandate COVID vaccinations for people whose medical histories and comorbidities could potentially be threatened or put at risk by those things. I've mentioned this personal story I've had many times that I experienced in Kenya, which involved a child being used as a guinea pig who was immunocompromised by a large pharmaceutical company. So just my background always kind of, I have a little cynicism to me on this, but I do understand legitimate concerns of safety on the part of the governmental medical representation here today, and I also understand the legitimate interests of people who want freedom and autonomy over their own bodies. So we're going to continue this conversation. I believe that's all we have for everyone today, and I thank you for your participation.